Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture with a special mini-series in Landscape Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today's book is The Bird-Friendly City, Creating Safe Urban Habitats by Timothy Bentley and is published by Island Press in 2020. So, hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Tricia. Nice to be here.
Let's start with, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I teach at the University of Virginia. I'm a professor in the Urban and Environmental Planning Department in the School of Architecture. I've been teaching here for a long time, since the 1980s, actually. And a lot of my work has to do with nature in cities and how we can have compact, dense, sustainable cities, but also cities that connect us to the natural world.
And what was your motivation for writing this book?
Well, it's a sort of a long answer. I think I've been a bird lover all my life and have fond memories of watching birds and listening to birds growing up. And I had a couple of parents, a mom in particular, who loved birds. And it's part of a larger interest of mine in nature and the power of the natural world. So it is definitely grows out of work that I've been doing, we've been doing here at UVA around this idea of biophilic cities, that cities that connect us to nature. So this builds on this concept of biophilia, that we are innately drawn to nature, that we need nature to be fully happy, healthy, lead meaningful lives. And so birds, for me, are a big part of that, a big part of the nature that affects me and that I enjoy. I guess the other motivation is one of concern for birds, the state of birds, the sort of threats to birds and bird life. And over my time teaching, I've had a number of episodes where I've discovered dead birds or seen collisions, bird building collisions. And so a sense of concern, I think, about the impacts that buildings and the design in the built environment has had on birds and bird life. And so there's sort of an intersection then between sort of my personal background and my professional life.
Now, I did hear in your book that you were are you still a pilot?
Well, no. I mean, I don't think they ever take the license away from you, but it's been many years since I've done any flying, but I grew up in a flying household. My dad was a United Airlines pilot, and we had a small plane. And so I had a pilot's license when I was 17. It was more important to me actually than getting a driver's license, which was a big deal for, you know, teenagers in those days. And then I did a lot of sailplane flying as well, gliders. And so, yeah, so I carry with me a lot of that early flying life, but I don't really fly anymore now.
Well, this is all side conversation. Do you think that we like birds because we're a little bit jealous that we can't fly?
Well, I think there's some of that, definitely. I think in the book somewhere, I talk about the Wright brothers and how they, you know, were inspired by watching turkey vultures soaring, which is something when I did a lot of sailplane flying, that was what we thermaled as well. We went looking for those masses of hot air that would keep us up longer. And so we actually would head towards the turkey vultures. We certainly are inspired by them. And I think that's probably true. A lot of us just could imagine what flying would be like. And that's, you know, power planes are great. Sailplanes are really better in that sense of kind of giving a sense of what it would actually feel like to be a bird. And you feel like those long wings are extensions, you know, of your body. You really feel like that. So I think that's right. I think you're right. I think we're envious. We're fascinated. We're curious and we're inspired by birds.
So, what are the benefits of birds? What do birds, we'll start with that. What do birds do for us, for people? Why should I like birds?
Well, many reasons. And you know, certainly there are really important ecological services provided by birds and you know, many sort of utilitarian benefits that birds provide to humans. I mean, that would be one answer. That we're in the middle of this pandemic, and one of the things that I've been impressed by, I mean, it's a really hard time for all of us, obviously. But if there is any silver lining to this time, it is the recognition or re-recognition of how important nature is and what a saving grace, what a balm it has been for a lot of us. And birds are a big part of that. So part of the answer is birds make us feel better, make us happy, give us moments of awe and moments of joy when we need that, especially now. And I don't know how many times now people have told me about how they, during the lockdown, you know, they're watching birds, listening to birds. And I had someone ask me the other day, are the birds louder than they used to be? Are there more birds? Well, there aren't. I mean, that this was someone asking me during the spring migration, and they were in New York City, and there probably were more birds moving around them. But it's this pandemic, this time when maybe we have a little bit more time to be paying attention to birds, and we're hearing things. Maybe you know, a lot of cities have been quieter, and we're able to hear birds. So that's, you know, one answer is that we absolutely need birds to be healthy, happy. This goes back again to the concept of biophilia, and I certainly react this way when I walk out of this room after this interview and I see and hear birds around me. It is uplifting, right? The other answer is that that's a pretty anthropocentric way of answering, right? So birds are here as we are here. They have inherent worth. They have intrinsic value, irrespective of the value they provide to humans, and they have a right to exist. And so that's another way of answering, I think.
That's true. They have a right to exist, just as all other creatures and plants have a right to exist on planet Earth.
Right.
What about the ecosystem values? Because that's a buzzword anymore, is ecosystem benefits. What do birds do in the environment? How do they keep things humming? What do they do?
Well, they can, you know, they eat insects. They can control, you know, that aspect of what they do, pest management services. You know, there are complex ecosystem relationships. When you take a bird, you know, out of the equation, There are cascading impacts associated with that. There's no question that depending on the bird and the species of bird, I was talking about turkey vultures, you know, and that's a really interesting bird to talk about from an ecosystem services perspective. And we've seen actually a rapid, huge decline in vulture populations in some parts of India and some parts, other parts of the world, really all other species besides the turkey vulture and the black vulture that are indigenous to North America, big plummets. And what that has meant is cascading effects. Well, why? Because they are, you know, nature's cleaner uppers, if you will. And they do so much for us. And it's too bad that I think a lot of people think about a species like a turkey vulture and they're turned off. I'm not sure why. They're lovely, beautiful, fascinating birds, but they clean up a lot of stuff. You know, they have evolved to be able to process and digest toxins and things that would kill humans. And they're out there, you know, every day, cleaning up the, you know, roadkill and the other things that, you know, that would otherwise be there. I don't know if you've ever seen a turkey vulture by the side of the road or, but they're incredible in that way. So that's one, you know, one example of sort of under-accounted, underappreciated, ecological services provided by that one species.
So I guess we should talk about, you know, birds are, as we all know, declining, and the reasons for that. What are the reasons for bird populations? We're losing our birds. What's happening? Why?
Yeah, so it's a number of different things going on. Obviously, climate change is a huge culprit and is a huge threat and will be a huge threat moving forward. But it's also habitat destruction, and many of the birds we love are migratory birds, and they're moving around, and they not only need to have habitat in one place, but in multiple places, right? And so we've seen deforestation, and we've seen loss of habitats that birds depend upon. So, and then, you know, increased use of and increased toxicity to the pesticides and herbicides that we're using, all interconnected, right? All these things are interconnected. We're converting land from forest to agriculture. And then we're, you know, doing all kinds of herbicides and pesticides and that kill the insects that many birds depend upon for survival. So there are all these larger systemic problems that we need to address. But I'm an urban planner, and I in this book tends to kind of look at it through the lens of a city. And so there are a whole bunch of really significant threats to birds connected to human settlement, to built environments, right? So glass being a big one, glass in buildings, and that birds don't really haven't evolved really to recognize glass, the barrier of glass. They don't see it. What they see is often a reflection of trees or vegetation, outside the building. It's being reflected, or clouds. And so we have a huge number of millions of birds that are killed from or injured from building strikes. So that's a big danger. And then along with human settlement, we bring things like, you know, domestic cats and domestic and feral cats, an even bigger level of threat in terms of at least the estimates of the number of birds killed by cats. So those are just some of the threats. I mean, we cities are bright. We have a huge problem with light pollution, and that has multiple effects on birds, especially during periods of migration when we have literally millions of birds moving through urban areas, and they end up being drawn to those lights, often becoming exhausted, disoriented, falling to the ground, making them vulnerable to striking that window. So a lot of cities now, of course, are working on or have some form of lights out initiative or program to try to combat that. But, we can't see the Milky Way. We can't see the night sky. We've lost that for most Americans. You can't, with your naked eye, you can't connect to that night sky. So the lighting issue, the light pollution is a problem for lots of reasons. But it's certainly a problem for birds and bats and other critters.
So, well, let's take these one at a time. We can't talk about birds without talking about cats. So, now I will say I love my kitty cat, and she's a cute little kitten sitting here, and I love birds too. I can love them both. And I love what my mom said. She goes, I just wish everything I loved stopped eating something else that I love.
Oh, right.
can cats and birds, can they get along?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. There are a number of things that we can do. And the book is largely about telling stories of what cities have been doing and organizations in those cities. And I should say, I haven't said this yet. I should say that I'm certainly no bird expert. I'm a bird lover, and so my emphasis has really been on trying to kind of understand what we can do in cities that will benefit birds, and that's a really tough one because it pits often our love of cats, against our love of birds. It shouldn't be that way. And I think that's one answer, is that we can find some common ground. And it's a love of other forms of life, right? And that's biophilic. And so what can you do? Whether there are, programs for addressing feral cats and feral cat colonies, lots of controversy around this, this capture release, recapture or capture release, neuter, spay and neutering feral cats and then putting them back out, and feeding colonies. A lot of controversy around that and quite a bit of disagreement among folks in the, about what's best for birds and what's, best for the cats. But there are some things. The book talks about catios, and I don't know if that's a term you've heard before, but this is an initiative that's been promoted through an alliance, really, between the Feral Cats Coalition in Oregon and Portland Audubon. And catios are cat patios, is where the word comes from, really. But these are enclosed outdoor spaces, usually connected to a house, that provide the opportunity for a pet cat to be outside, in a way, to have that outdoor experience, but they're not free, to predate on a bird. So Portland organizes this, has this annual catio tour, which is really wonderful. So they usually put on display, 10 catios around the city. And it's like a garden tour or an open house tour where you go from one to the next and you get to see, different catio designs. So that's one idea of, but I think we've, there are programs for encouraging folks to keep their cats indoors. That's another really effective way of going about this. And particularly at, key times during the year, nesting times, for example. So that's another option. Of course, there are these, talk about this in the book. There are companies that make products like the rainbow collar, which is this big puffed up collar. There's a picture in the book of my cat actually wearing one of these collars, and it's a multicolored, it's a rainbow colored collar, designed with, you know, has some science behind it. These are colors that, that just the size of the collar means that the bird is more likely to see that cat. But then these are colors that birds are likely to notice. And so that, and there's another product that's more of a bib that you put on your cat that makes it, doesn't impede their movement, but it really makes it hard for a cat to lunge and attack a bird. So there are a number of things like that, that that pet owners could do, that cat owners could do.
That's true.
By the way, I wanted to say, I talked about this, mentioned this idea of biophilic cities, and we have a network of biophilic cities. One of them is Portland. And one of the things that we've been doing is producing short documentary films, 5 to 7 minute films about really innovative stories of innovative work that cities are doing. And we have a 5 minute film about the catio tours, the catio tour. So if anyone's interested in seeing that, we actually spent the day kind of following around folks as they saw these catio tours, visited several of the specific catios. And so that would be a good resource for anyone interested in more in learning more about what a catio is.
Oh, well, you can feel free to promote it here. Do you have a website or a YouTube channel?
We do. It's biophiliccities.org. And there's a, when you go to that site, there's a drop down, there's a film page that where you can find all of these short documentary films, including that one.
Well, that sounds like a good resource. And so what else can we do? My master's degree is in landscape architecture. And of course, yeah. We interact with urban planners. What are some other things that we can design for cities? You talk about here a vertical bird city. What is that about?
Yeah. So there are, I think, many ways that we could move beyond simply reducing the dangers for birds in cities. And the first thing is, glass. And so we now have cities like San Francisco, first city to adopt mandatory safe, bird safe design standards. Other cities now are following suit. New York has adopted a similar standard, basically mandates the use of bird safe glass in buildings, and particularly in those areas, the height from the ground where birds are likely to strike. So this is tried and true, pretty, a basic thing that we ought to do everywhere in every city. And this is essentially fritted glass, pattern baked into glass that a pattern, a fritting pattern that a bird can see. It basically makes the glass visible. There are a lot of other products and a lot of other technologies, UV treated glass, and even some really low tech things like paracords that can be hanging down in front of a glass window. This is a good option for retrofitting even a single family home, and anything that will make that glass visible to birds. So that's one thing, but that's sort of taking away the danger. We can do more of the things that you would want to do as a landscape architect, I think. And that's gets us into designing gardens and thinking about how we can convert that not very bird friendly single species, turf grass lawn into something that would be a bird friendly lawn or backyard. And actually, here's another example of how Portland Audubon has been sort of pioneering, and they have one of the most rigorous and extensive backyard wildlife certification programs. And it's again about using native species, things that are going to supply the kinds of environment, the kind of habitats that birds will need. And a lot of evidence. I have to mention Doug Tallamy, this ecologist from University of Delaware, who's done all of this research, pretty compelling work showing that, you know, when you think about what a nesting bird will need when it comes to caterpillars, for example, a remarkable number of caterpillars that are needed to sustain young chicks when they're growing up. And those caterpillars are more likely, you're going to get much more productivity from a native tree that's a host to that native caterpillar, a tree like a white oak, for example, and at least in this part of the U.S. So thinking about how we can convert the spaces around our homes and the spaces around our cities, right? So it's questions about planting, you know, many native plants, but also many native species of trees, so that our cities writ large are more, you know, habitable and provide better habitat, better chances for survival for birds. And things like green rooftops, for example. There's a lot of discussion in the book about New York City and how in the installation of green rooftops, for example, on the Jacob Javits Center in New York, it's become a nesting site now for birds. And so the sort of leftover spaces of cities, the places we kind of forget, could be places of habitat for birds. That rooftop could be a meadow. Now we want to be, you know, careful. We want to make sure that by doing that, we don't expose birds to, you know, the dangers of glass that they wouldn't have had before. So we got to do a lot of these things in tandem if we can.
Yeah, you have here a chapter, you know, Design for Safe Passage, you're talking about San Francisco, and I'll give you a break just a second. I like this this quote you have here at the beginning. You got some great quotes in the book. It's once upon a time when women were birds, there was a simple understanding that to sing at dawn and to sing at dusk was to heal the world through joy. The birds still remember what we have forgotten, that the world is meant to be celebrated. Do you think that maybe we are appreciating that more since we have been isolated and down with the pandemic?
Yeah, I think we absolutely have. And not to minimize the struggles that many people are going through right now. But again, birds are a profoundly uplifting aspect of our lives. And they can, you know, they can make us happy and feel better and more connected to the world. Again, they provide a sense of normalcy, or, you know, a sense of constancy in a world that seems topsy-turvy right now, right? So I think that's absolutely right. And they already connect us to the places in which we live, and this deeper, Terry Tempest Williams talking about that, you know, that connection, the deep connection to place that she writes so eloquently about. And birds help us to do that. You know, I tell the story, I think in the preface or the introduction, about how important the wood thrush is to me. And growing up, you know, I listen to that bird now when I hear that, but I look forward to hearing that bird. Sorry.
That's okay. I'll give you
this is your
again.
Editing. This is your editing. After I told you it never rings. I'm here all day and it never rings. It's so strange. I don't even know who this is. Weird. Let's
see. Start over again.
You have to ask that question again.
Okay, let's start back with you remember the thrush and why it was so important to you.
Yeah, so I think that birds, and I often make this case in slideshows, and I sometimes, with students, play them bird songs. And the wood thrush is this remarkable flute-like song. It's unlike anything else. It's beautiful. So there's that, just that deep, beautiful, enjoyable listening to it. But it's also something that connects us to the places in which we live. So whenever I hear that song, I look forward to it. I've been recording actually for a few years now, the first day of the spring when I hear it, when they arrive. And it brings me joy, and it reminds me of my childhood, and it makes me think of my parents, and it connects me to the places where I spent time growing up, and the place, where I lived. So birds are something that deeply connect us to land and place and environment.
And you talk about, what is San Francisco doing? What are some things they're doing there to help the birds on? Because that's one of the major 8 flyaways for migratory birds.
Yeah, so there are a couple of chapters that have a lot of San Francisco in them. I think probably, so many interesting things that city and the Bay Area have done. So I mentioned the first American city to have adopted mandatory bird safe design standards. That's impressive. It is a city that has it. They're also, by the way, a part of our BioPhilic Cities network. They're a partner city. So we've kind of watched them over a number of years. They have a number of innovative programs for converting small spaces into forms of nature and renaturalizing parts of the city. A lot of people know about parklets, the idea of parklets taking 2 or 3 on-street parking spaces and converting them to small parks. That's something they're known for around the world. But they have other initiatives like a street parks program where neighborhoods can capture the space between the median strips of places where they can create small parks. They have a sidewalk gardens permit that lets neighborhoods take up pavement and install gardens, which is quite amazing. And there a couple of thousand permits have been issued so far to in that city to do that. So the more we can green and renaturalize those urban environments, the better spaces they will be for birds. So those are some of the things. On a more kind of regional scale, it's really impressive that this Bay Area has two kind of parallel regional trail systems. One, the Bay Trail that goes around the edge of San Francisco Bay, and it's a major birding venue, and you get to see a lot of water birds and shore birds, and then a kind of parallel trail. It came about in a different way, but along the ridge line around the bay. So there you will see different kinds of birds, and together each one of them, when they're finished, will be 500 miles long. So when they're completed, that's 1,000 miles of trails in the Bay Area. That this, in addition to all of this, the network of trails that exist at a more local city level. So that's a part of what cities can do as well, create the infrastructure, the opportunities for residents to be outside and to be on a trail and to be in places where they can see birds and different kinds of birds. So that's something San Francisco's excelled at, I think.
Well, let me ask you, since you're a professor and you talked about this a little bit, are you teaching any studios about designing for birds? In urban design or landscape architecture?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I'm not a designer. I'm more of a planner at the scale. I'm a designer in a sense, but it's more policy and programs and less about, actually designing a space. My focus is again more at the urban level. But we have a landscape architecture program here. We have an architecture program. So these are students learning, you know, how to design buildings and how to design landscapes around buildings. And I would love for those students to have more exposure to birds and to what, you know, to the design options and ideas that will make those spaces more bird friendly. I don't think that there's that we're unusual, though. I don't think that we're teaching very much about birds in architecture schools, and I think that's too bad. And I think at a minimum, anybody going through an architecture program today ought to be aware of how dangerous buildings and how dangerous glass is for birds, and ought to incorporate those bird friendly design elements into any design work. So any studio thinking about designing a building needs to think about birds. And the same would be true for a landscape studio.
Well, that's true. You know, I was the only one in my program who I just took an interest in it just because I think of how I grew up and where I grew up. And I just took it on myself to do some more research about, yeah, just designing spaces for birds. So your book would be a great resource for any of those professors thinking about that, a bird studio.
Yeah, I would hope so. And you know, it's interesting. I think I mentioned this somewhere in the book. Just as an observer of a lot of design work, it seems like almost any rendering of a building, of say a library or, you know, any major project, will frequently have birds, you know, sort of in there somewhere. It's almost just a little visual dressing. And then to me, the irony is that we dress up these renderings with birds, but I, you know, have no confidence that the actual design of that building or that facility or whatever it is, you know, is bird friendly and took birds into account. So absolutely. Birds, and there again, you started by asking me about the ecosystem services of birds, and we talked about the benefits of having birds around us. They are a proxy for the quality of the environments, you know, they are in. So the quality of environments that we spend time in cities. And if there aren't birds, it's probably not a really good place for people either.
Yeah, I was going to say, what would happen to the world if there were no birds tomorrow?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of again, there'd be a lot of cascading effects in ecosystem impacts, but more profoundly, would be just the loss, the loss of the joy and pleasure and connection that we get from having birds around us, and how diminished our lives and our world would be. I can't imagine a world without birds.
I can't either. And yeah, that's a good point about studios. That yeah, they always just stick a few birds in the sky, but without
right.
Think about.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just throw a few birds in there, a few clouds, and you know, and without really thinking about what it is.
Don't want to sort of overstate this case, but it does seem like, yeah, let's put some birds there, you know, and let's dress it up, and let's use those images of birds to make this design look more natureful, maybe more biophilic than it really is. And I'm all for making birds a central design element. And in that case, then yeah, it's entirely legitimate to have birds in renderings.
Well, let's go to, you have also Toronto in here, and it has been described in your book as a migratory bird superhighway because millions of birds travel through this urban region during the fall and spring migrations. What is Toronto doing?
Well, Toronto has been one of those really leading cities when it comes to birds. And it's the result of a combination of things that the city has done, But it's also been people and organizations. And there's a group called FLAP, an acronym that is an organization actually that has been spearheading the bird conservation issue for many, many years. And a fellow named Michael Majeur, who founded FLAP, he, an artist actually, who just became very concerned about birds and the impact of birds flying through that city and hitting glass, hitting buildings, and wanted to do something about it. And so one of the remarkable things they started to do, through volunteer, through this army of volunteers, is basically during peak migration in the spring and fall, volunteers go around the city, particular places, and look for injured or dead birds. And this, I think, maybe the first city where this happened in any meaningful way. And they collect the birds, the injured birds, get collected and sent to a wildlife center for treatment. But they collect they keep the dead birds, they collect them, and then once a year, they display them. And there are pictures of this in the book, but they display them in patterns and very creative ways. But the idea is to show, demonstrate in a kind of visually compelling way, the impact on birds, the impact of buildings and the city, and to raise awareness about the dangers. And so that has led the city to do a number of things, but they really were the first city to have adopted these minimum bird safe design standards. So really the first city in North America, predating San Francisco. So they have other things that they're doing. They have some wonderful parks that are talked about a little bit in the book, and that are really important habitats for birds. But it's definitely a city with a lot of people and a lot of energy around bird conservation.
Well, but I didn't know, kind of going off of that, is, highways. How do highways, just roads, Chapter 10, the struggle to save birds and bush from a proposed highway, how do highways affect birds?
Yeah, well, in multiple ways. So that's a story from Australia. So there's a chapter about this Row 8 highway in Western Australia. And we have a film about that as well, if anyone wants to learn more. But it's a story of a proposed highway expansion project that the community just rose up against and eventually was able to stop. And they were able to actually change the political landscape and led to the changing of the state government, actually the state the premier, the governor, essentially a governor. These were ancient Banksia woodlands that were habitat for a lot of birds, a lot of other animals as well. And they're also sacred lands for the indigenous Noongar people. So in that particular story, the highway was threatening habitat loss. So, one of the things I say in the book is that every city needs to think carefully about, what it does with these kinds of infrastructure, save, protect as much as possible. This was a project that didn't have a lot of real justification. We really shouldn't be building, or expanding highways where we have alternatives, and we always have an alternative, it seems like. So that's one story. You could also talk about roads in terms of the roads themselves being, you know, not just taking habitat, but the actual movement of cars and trucks and vehicles on roadways representing a threat to birds also. And there are some estimates about, you know, bird vehicle strikes. And I think that's something we don't really understand as well. There has been a big push in many cities. Edmonton, Canada is a wonderful example of a city that's been building a lot of wildlife passages so that animals big and small can move across the landscape without being hit by a car. Birds are a little different, of course. They're flying. They're, you know, we need to have connected landscapes, and we need to minimize sort of gaps for birds. And we do need to be thinking about road designs that minimize the chance of birds being hit by cars or trucks. And sometimes that means just being careful about where we're attracting birds, right? So planting attractive berry bushes in the median of a busy road might not be a good thing, you know, from a bird conservation point of view.
Yeah, that's true. And I hate to admit it that, you know, it's kind of like one of those deer in headlight moments. I've been driving down the road and I see the bird and it sees me and it's just too late at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, driving and I'm like, oh, I feel so guilty. I feel so horrible when it happens.
Yeah. Well, one of the answers is we're moving too fast. We're driving too fast in lots of, particularly in neighborhood, you know, spaces. And so reducing speed limits and finding ways to, you know, slow down traffic, slow down. It's good for all of us, right? It's good for safety for kids and better for bicyclists. And we need to just be, you know, moving in the direction of more shared space sort of models, this super block kind of idea from Barcelona and other places where, you know, where we're creating spaces where we can sit and kids can play and where the traffic may be moving, you know, very, very slowly. Those are spaces that are going to be safer for birds as well as for people.
Well, I have to ask you one more thing. Now, what is the Tree City USA you have on page 178? It was every city, a bird city. Can cities become certified as bird cities, or what is this about?
Yeah, so the whole book really, of course, is about what it might mean to be a bird-friendly city. And I don't necessarily, I lay out a lot of things we've talked about today, a lot of the qualities of what would be a bird-friendly or bird-safe city. And it's not necessarily meant to be any kind of certification system. And it's a kind of a subset of this biophilic cities network that I've talked about. And there is a joining process and a set of things that you have to do to be part of the network. But there is a movement particularly within Audubon, to start these bird city certification systems. And so Bird City, Wisconsin is one that I talk about in the book and spent some little bit of time with them trying to understand it. And it's a kind of a point system. There's certain things that you have to do in that city, but then you get points for doing, you get to choose which things you want to do in your city, creating new habitat, creating a educational program around birds, doing something to acknowledge or celebrate the International Migratory Bird Day. I think that's a requirement in most of them. And then you are certified as, you know, being in this bird city. And I think that's a really good step and a good, you know, beginning point for cities to begin to think about, you know, how what they do, their policies, their investments, their design of things that get built, buildings and roads and so on, affect birds. I think that's a really good way to give visibility to birds at that local level.
Well, maybe if there's any silver lining, there's always a silver lining to everything happening right now with the pandemic. It's that I like what you said, chapter 12, you know, cultivating a bird caring citizenry. Maybe we'll care a little bit more about our habitat and how it affects us and how we affect it.
I hope so. That would be a great outcome from the book. I would, that would be wonderful. So I think it's caring, you know, again, it's creating bird-friendly habitats and environments and cities is about creating better places for humans. So it all goes together.
Well, Tim, thank you for being here today. I know we've taken up a lot of your time and I've really enjoyed this conversation. You know, there's lots of bird lovers out there. So can you tell the audience, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Yeah, so it's all connected in one way or another to the idea of nature in cities. So so we have just earlier today was on a call with a bunch of folks in Lima, Peru, and we have almost every day a call or some form of a Zoom or a contact of some sort with a city in some other part of the world. So right now we are very much trying to grow our biophilic cities networks. I'm spending quite a lot of time. It's a current and future project. It's something kind of continuously working on. But we think this idea of connecting to nature, the idea that we need this nature fix, that it's not something optional. We absolutely need to have birds and nature around us. And it's a birthright. Every human being deserves to have that contact with nature. So we're building this movement. And so spending a lot of time on that. And we're hoping to have cities in other parts of the world. We have one city now in India. But we want cities in China. We want cities in Africa. And so we're just really trying to move forward this vision of cities, natureful vision, vision of city that shares space with birds and other forms of life, and a global movement. And so that's really what I'm working on and will continue to work on in the next months.
Oh, that sounds like a fabulous goal.
Yes, we think so. Hope so.
Yes.
It is a goal. It's an aspiration. But we're optimistic. We're moving ahead.
We're all anxious anyway to get outside again.
Yes, absolutely. Let's all do that.
Well, again, Tim, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed the conversation.